Walt Whitman is a very imposing figure in American literature for a number of reasons, and he's written an awful lot of good poetry, and when all is said and done, that's the reason you read him, because he's a good poet, not for anything else, really. A lot of times writers are interesting because of their lives or because of other things they've done. Byron, because he got involved in Greece, or Wordsworth, because he was involved in France. You don't remember Wordsworth or Byron, because you remember them because Wordsworth wrote a handful of very, very fine poems, maybe five or six excellent poems. And you remember Byron because he wrote at least that many fine poems. And Whitman did some very interesting things in his life, but we don't remember Whitman for those things. Remember him because he was a poet. 1855. Yesterday I said in 1862 Emily Dickinson sent four poems to an editor and he rejected them because he didn't understand them. And that was kind of an important point in, just kind of a fun important point in literature. But 1855 is really an important date in literature, because that's the time Whitman came out with his first edition of Leaves of Grass, his book called Leaves of Grass. He only wrote one book in his lifetime, but it was the same title, Leaves of Grass. He just kept expanding it. Every time he got some new poems, he'd go to the editor and say, push these in, and push these in, and put these in here, until finally he went through, I don't know how many editions, seven or eight editions of Leaves of Grass. And it was always the same title, and Whitman thought the same book, but just different poems. And like most poets, I guess, he fell on hard times, and he suffered a stroke and was partially paralyzed and didn't have any money, and he was reduced to, I don't know if reduced is the right word, but it's a word. He was reduced to selling his own poems on the street corner. Not that that's the worst of all possible fates for a poet. If you want to get them sold, you have to sell them yourself. In fact, there are more backyard poets presses today than any time in history. People typing up their own poems on ditto masters, running them off, putting them together in some kind of a booklet and shipping them off to who knows where. And the reason that's so is obvious, because publishers in New York won't publish poems because poems lose money. A publisher told me last year that he has to, if he has 20 books he publishes, one of them has to make money because the other 19 won't. Well, that's sad. And poetry will never make him money. And any publisher who publishes poetry, outside of the guy who publishes Rod McEwen, and I think that's Random House, they do that as a labor of love, because they know poetry should be published, but they know it's going to lose money. They all lose money, except Rod McEwen. And he makes Random House all kinds of money. Big bucks, or big drafts, as we said in Greece. Lots of money. But I'm not going to talk about Rod McEwen. If I had 6 months up here, I would never get around to talking about Rod McEwen. But he makes the money, I give him that. No, I don't give him that, come to think. But anyway, 1855, Whitman suddenly, and I mean suddenly, published Leaves of Grass. After having, he was about, I don't know how old he was, he was born in, 1819. So he had, in his 30s, and it's a brand new sort of poem he's writing, a brand new type of poetry. And there was really no explanation for Whitman's change in the kind of poem he started writing. This poem you have in front of you, Song of Myself, is a very long poem. It's about 50 pages long in a paperback size like this. And I've kind of taken out some passages that I think are meaningful in one way or another. And I thought we'd just go through some of these to help to understand Whitman and what he was about. Song of Myself, as you might imagine, it was a bombshell in the 19th century, because of the title. You just don't write Song of Myself. It's very egocentric, and people are used to, as I said yesterday, Longfellow and his sonorous strains and full of dignity and that sort of thing. And here we have a fellow coming along and says, I'm going to write a poem, and guess who it's going to be about? Number one, me. And people didn't like that. They really didn't like Walt very much at all. In fact, they so disliked him, they ignored him, which is the worst fate of all for a writer, or for anybody, I guess, to be ignored. So he went back to his rooms and did his own, wrote them up, his own hand copies, and peddled them, and sent them to some people, and people would take a look at them and say, oh, this is terrible. Because in Song of Myself, he gets very carried away with himself. He's celebrating himself. And he's got a line here that says, the smell of my armpits, aroma finer than prayer. Mm-hmm. And people said, wait a minute. I don't want to hear about your armpits. Don't talk to me. And in another line here, it says, there's so much of me, and it's all so luscious. And again, they say, oh, come on. You're not luscious, and your armpits are not finer than prayer. I don't want to hear about that kind of stuff. So they would chuck his stuff away. They just didn't go for it. So he sent a copy to Emerson, and that's standard operating procedure. If you want to be recognized by the literati of the day, you pick out the man and send him the stuff. See what he says. Well, Emerson was thumbing through it and was about to chuck it away, but he was at least smarter than old Higginson, who handled Emily Dickinson, or mishandled Dickinson. Whitman was a genius in his own right, and he recognized genius when he saw it and had the courage to say so. And he wrote Whitman back a letter saying, keep up the good work, and then I think you've got talent. And right in the middle of the letter said, I greet you on the threshold of a brilliant career. And when Whitman saw that, he clipped that out and rushed to the editor, the printer, and had a few thousand of his copies printed up and said, I want this emblazoned on the cover. I greet you on the threshold of a brilliant career, Ralph Waldo Emerson. Well, when people saw that, they went out and bought it. That's the old Emperor's New Clothes theory of art. You know, you applaud for fear of being seen as an ignorant person. So people who were chucking it in the trash can on Saturday, on Monday they were buying it because Emerson said it was good. And if Emerson says it's good, obviously it must be good. It's amazing to me how little confidence people have in themselves and their own ability to say what they like and what they do not like in art. That may be a Philistine way of going about it, but I still think what feels good and what appeals to you subjectively is an awfully good indicator. There's an awful lot of education that goes into art, granted, but if you don't have the subjective taste buds to start, all the education won't do a heck of a lot. Well, inside this great book called Leaves of Grass was one particular poem that stands out among all others, I think. That's Song of Myself. And that's the one that I wanted to take a look at today. And there's some more copies here. If anybody didn't get one, if you want to kind of follow along, just send up a flare and we'll send one back to you. You notice, I've copied the first section intact. It's worth looking at. I celebrate myself and sing myself. And what I assume, you shall assume. Well, right off the bat, the people in the 19th century said, no, I can't do that. What I assume, you shall assume? You know, who says so? Well, he goes on to say, why? For every atom belonging to me, as good belongs to you. I loaf and invite my soul. And that turned them off again, because they had just read Longfellow, who said, learn to labor and to wait. That kind of work ethic. And here's a guy who's saying, I loaf and invite my soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a spear of summer grass. My tongue, every atom of my blood, formed from this soil, this air, born here of parents, born here from parents the same, and their parents the same. I now, 37 years old, in perfect health begin, hoping to cease not till death. Creeds and schools in abeyance, retiring back a while, sufficed at what they are, but never forgotten. I harbor for good or bad. I permit to speak at every hazard, nature without check, with original energy. And with that opening paragraph, the people thought, what have we got here? What kind of a man is this nut? And they didn't like the shape. This is free verse. Can't have that. They're used to by the shore of Gitche Gumee again. And this is not by the shores of anything. It's just all over the page, as you can see. And a line like, born here of parents born here from parents the same and their parents the same, that is just not poetry. That is not poetry as the people were used to reading poetry. And it still shakes some people up because it seems rather rambling. It's a rather loose line. And in our poetry session last night, we were talking about if a line has got to be like a rubber band stretched taut, you've got to be able to flick it and have it hum. In prose, if you've got a novel of 50 to 80,000 words, you can waste a few thousand words. Not every word in a novel has to be meaningful, and that rubber band comes together and it's a little limp. But in a poem, it should be taut, and every line's got to be important, every word. Well, that line obviously doesn't follow that rule. And when you write a long poem, and Song of Myself is 50 pages long, you can't do that. You can't sustain that. In fact, Edgar Allan Poe said there's no such thing as a long poem. He says it's just a short poem held together by bits of prose. And he should know, since he wrote The Raven and violated his own dictum there too, because The Raven has a lot of lines that don't do anything. But he's 37 years old. He says, now I'm ready to begin. And we try as you might by reading a biography of Whitman, it's impossible, I think, to put your finger on the psychological conversion that he must have undergone in order to start writing this new kind of poetry. Prior to this, he was writing fairly conventional poetry. But this is new stuff. He's celebrating himself and us because he really believed that we are brothers and sisters, and the atoms that belong to him belong to us, and they're inextricable. And that's a new kind of a thought for poets to talk about. He realized he was writing new stuff in a new way. He knew that. He was no dummy. And in a couple of lines I just took out of section two, the sound of the belched words of my voice loomed to the eddies of the wind, loose to the eddies of the wind. He calls his words belched. Later on he calls it his loiter, his gab. He knows it's going to sound rough. But he can't help it. He's got to write the way he feels. He was caught up in the Turner thesis of westward expansion, that there's no end to the United States, what America could become. Whitman was on the edge of the advancing frontier. He wrote that way. He lived that way. And everything he writes in Song of Myself is onward and upward, damn the torpedoes, excelsior, that kind of spirit. And if his words sound belched, then they sound belched. The play of shine and shade on the trees as the supple boughs wag. That's just one line I took out of section two. It's indicative of what he was trying to do. He wants to show the relationship of everything to each other. Play of shine and shade. How things are, like as Hopkins said again, dazzle dim, sweet sour. There was never any more inception than there is now, nor any more youth or age than there is now. And will never be any more perfection than there is now, nor any more heaven or hell than there is now. He had that beautiful paradox of living in the moment, the exact moment, and yet knowing that moment was eternity, and it's all you're likely to know of eternity is now. And there's no difference between now and eternity. Section 5 aroused the ire, too, of some of the preachers of the day. I believe in you, my soul. The other I am must not abase itself to you, and you must not be abased to the other. Loaf with me on the grass, loose the stop from your throat. Not words, not music or rhyme I want, not customs or lectures, not even the best. Only the lull I like, the hum of your velvet voice. He's talking to his soul now, which is the same way all poets, since poets have talked to their soul or their psyche, or in the old days they call it the muse, right? Remember Homer in the Iliad and the Odyssey? He talked to the muse, he prayed to the muse to give him wisdom and all that sort of thing. Section 5 gets into the Song of Myself, and it's a very sensual way to get into this poem. I mind how once we lay such a transparent summer morning, how you settled your head athwart my hips and gently turned over upon me, and parted the shirt from my bosom bone and plunged your tongue to my bare-striped heart, and reached till you felt my beard and reached till you held my feet. Swiftly arose and spread around me the peace and knowledge that pass all the argument of the earth, and I know that the hand of God is the promise of my own, and I know that the Spirit of God is the brother of my own, and that all men ever born are also my brothers, and the women my sisters and lovers. So what we have here, one way to look at this very long poem, it's in 52 sections, is a quest. It's a quest for self-knowledge that Walt Whitman is getting into. He's diving into that unfathomable sea that swims between your ears, his mind, his psyche. And the way he gets into this quest is via a sexual experience. And this is something also pretty new. People were used to experiences. They were used to the revelation of St. John. They'd read Daniel and Revelation and other books by prophets and mystics, but the usual way was to maybe lie on a bed of nails and castigate the flesh a little bit and try to separate the soul, keep the flesh down so the spirit can take off, and then you have the vision. Whitman says, yeah.
What about Song of Solomon?
Well, go ahead.
Talking about sexual language or sexual experience for meaning something else, about that certain.
Yes, right, yeah. Not a whole lot between those two, I think. Yeah, you're right. It's good. I wish I had, I suppose we could look it up. Got a Bible around.
Okay.
Maybe somebody could find that. Do you want to find
the whole book?
Okay.
Speaking of Jerusalem in terms of a woman.
Yes. Uh-huh. Well, Whitman was off for Song of Solomon then, because he said, if I'm going to have an experience like that, if I'm going to have a mystical quest, it's going to be with the body. I'm not going to leave the body behind. And all the way through the poem, he makes a case for saying the body is not greater than the soul, but the soul is not greater than the body. And he wants to celebrate the flesh, celebrate the fact that he's a man, a virile specimen. He's a Hemingway character, kind of a chest thumper. And he says, if I'm going to have this mystical experience, I'm going as a person. I'm not going to separate the soul from the body. And so he gets into this mystical experience via sexual experience. And as we go along through the poem, he goes deeper and deeper into his self, into understanding who he is, and by understanding who he is, who other people are, and what America means to him. Till finally, he gets so deeply into himself that he gets lost and becomes frightened. In the poem later on, there are sections that show him having a very bad time, dangerous time, and hospitals are full of people who have been in those seas and have gotten lost and cannot find their way back to reality, and they spend their lifetimes or some portion of their lifetime lost and not able to get back. And Whitman did that and then did come back, but at the very depths he was frightened. At the very depths he said, I suffered, I was there. Agonies are one of my changes of garments, until he finally realizes the suffering of Christ on the cross and actually suffers that mentally, and then starts coming back slowly until when he's through the poem. That's one way to look. You can look at the poem a number of ways, I guess, but I wanted to tell you that to give you something to hang your thoughts on, that the poem is a quest, and he's trying to get into himself and figure out who he is, because he knows when he knows who he is, he will know who we are and what America should be.
Yeah. Sir, when you talk of is he kind of making a play on words for some type of a spiritual reason here when he talks about peace and knowledge that pass all argument of the earth, kind of like false and peace that passes all.
Yeah, I wouldn't be a bit surprised. I wouldn't be a bit surprised that he is. I don't know if he is for a fact, but it wouldn't surprise me that he was doing that. And he wants to make a point that when he goes into himself that you don't need anything. He said in the first section, I think, he said somewhere, something held in abeyance. Do you remember that line? Was that in the first section?
Creeds and schools in abeyance.
Yeah, creeds and schools in abeyance. He makes a point of that all through the poem. Talkers, lecturers, philosophers, teachers, ministers, get behind me. He said, I'm going alone, and I don't want to know anything. I want to go as ignorant as the day I was born, or as wise as the day I was born. And for Whitman, those are the same, that he is both wise and ignorant as a baby, the same. I said the name of his book was The Leaves of Grass, and then in section 6 he asks himself that question. A child said, what is grass? Fetching it to me with full hands, how could I answer the child? I do not know what it is any more than he. I guess it must be the flag of my disposition, out of hopeful green stuff woven, or I guess it is the handkerchief of the Lord. And now it seems to be the beautiful uncut hair of graves. And what do you think has become of the women and children? They are alive and well somewhere. The smallest sprout shows there is really no death. And if ever there was, it led forward life and does not wait at the end to arrest it and cease the moment life appeared. All goes onward and outward. Nothing collapses. And to die is different from what anyone supposed, and luckier. And there's one of Whitman's main themes, too, the idea of death. There's one of his most beautiful poems is When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed. It's about the death of Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln was a god to Whitman. He saw Lincoln once or twice during the Civil War, and Whitman was a male nurse in Washington, D.C., and he used to go out on the battlefields, and the surgeons would amputate, do field surgery. Whitman would be the one to pick up the amputated limbs and carry them off and put them in a ditch. He would be the one to go into the sick rooms, the hospitals, and read the Bible to the patients, or take letters home, or read books or stories or poems to the soldiers. And Lincoln was really a god to him. And when Lincoln died, of course, he wrote one of his most anthologized poems, O Captain, My Captain, and I'm sure you all remember that one. The fearful trip is done. Yes, sir.
How does a man that 33 years of age can come to say, and to die is different from anyone, what anyone supposed than lucky? What is his basis? You know, from what base does he jump? What is his support for that kind of a feeling or idea that he? How do you get there?
Do you answer that?
Well, one day I was in the library, and there was a book, I think, written by Burke in 1901, and it was categorizing all people who had mystical experiences, and Whitman was in there, and he supposedly had a vision, which is quite common, I guess. Lincoln was there, and something that we are one, and perhaps he really sensed that there's a lot more than we're aware of.
Yeah. And this poem is an attempt to explain that vision. Interestingly enough, he never explains it. I shouldn't say that till we're at the end, but it's probably obvious, because when you have a vision, it's your vision, and you can never explain it. That's why I revel. Who can read?
What has to do with what I asked?
What?
What has the vision got to do with what I asked?
Well, I suppose that his understanding of death is luckier came from the vision that he had suddenly, as St. Paul learned much in one flash, and we all have insights into things, insights into the future. This was his. And he realized, and all the way through his poetry, this idea of death as a beginning, not an ending, was very important to him. But how he came to have that, I'm not prepared to explain. But he obviously had it.
He isn't classified as a Christian poet, in quotes.
Not in quotes, no. Or maybe any other way, come to think of it.
So he was a very deeply religious man.
Yes, I think that's, we could say that. Certainly not orthodox, as so many poets are. That's an interesting question. I was just rereading a lot of Mark Van Doren the other day, and I'm always struck when I read Van Doren how religious his poems are. So many of them are so religious, and he never set foot in a church. You couldn't have dragged him there. And yet his poems are deeply spiritual and moving. And I've heard preachers quote him and use him as an example of the spiritual life. And knowing him as I do, I know he never went to church. But that's not particularly important, I think. In connection with your question, there's another interesting poem you may want to read sometime called Crossing Brooklyn Ferry. One of the things Whitman liked to do was just sit on the ferry and go back and forth. And he loved to feel all the people around him. And yet he couldn't stand to be touched. I've forgotten the medical term. It's something like, is there an MD in the house? Urosthesia or something like that. That's very close. You can't be touched. Your skin is so hypersensitive that even clothes. So he had to wear only silk shirts and dress just right, or he'd just go up the wall. And yet he loved people, and he loved the proximity to people. And yet he couldn't stand to be touched like that. And he would ride this ferry being conscious of all the people who had always been on that ferry going back and forth, and at the same time being conscious of when he was gone all the hundreds and thousands of people who would continue to be on that ferry, and he realized they're all the same. He was all the people who was ever going to ever have been on that ferry boat. You talk about the world in microcosm, that he was it. And all the way through literature you find people and poets who are aware of that one time or another. Wordsworth, in his beautiful ode on intimations of immortality, when he sees the flower and notices the flower dies but it's going to grow again, has the same kind of visionary concept. And Blake had it many, many times. Another thing he did was juxtapose. Oh, I started to mention something about Lincoln and out of the what was the poem? I said it was a beautiful poem. I just forgot it. When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloom. He has a beautiful poem within that poem called The Carol of Death, when he says, "Come, soothing death." And it is a beautiful thing, but very somber. And I'm not prepared yet to welcome death like Whitman did. But he was prepared, and the poem is really beautiful. And it's within the poem about the death of Lincoln. You should read that if you haven't read it in a long time. When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloom. And the story goes that as Lincoln's funeral cortege moved slowly through the streets of Washington, he placed a sprig of lilac on the casket as it went by. And a very moving poem. But in addition to the death motif, another thing he does is when you see things as one, you can't help but mix things together. And he does that a good deal. Some of the lines from section 8. The little one sleeps in its cradle. I lift the gauze and look a long time and silently brush away flies with my hand. The youngster and the red-faced girl turn aside at the bushy hill. I peeringly view them from the top. The suicide sprawls on the bloody floor of the bedroom. This is just some of the lines from that section. When you talk about the little child sleeping and doing something as gentle as brushing away flies, and the next thing, the suicide sprawls and the blood all over the pavement, that kind of thing. He runs these lines together very quickly, one after the other, in a catalog fashion. And often he's criticized for as the great cataloger, like a Sears and Roebuck catalog. Because some of his sections that I've got lines from are enormously long, maybe 5 or 6 pages long, one line after the other. He gets so caught up in seeing the oneness of things. He starts praising people, and he says, I am the Kentuckian crossing the Smoky Mountains. I am the Oregonian after gooey ducks. I am the Californian digging for gold. I am the Washingtonian, the person from Connecticut and the Alabama. You know, back and forth, the person after person and all their trades and all they do, and just rolls them off his tongue. And if you like Whitman, you love those catalogs. And if you tend not to like Whitman, you really get bored with him. And that goes back to what Poe warned. You know, you just can't write a long, no such thing as a long poem. It disintegrates into prose. Within the Song of Myself, though, in all these catalogs, he has little gems, sections that stand out, and they are poems in their own right, and number 11 is one of those. I see I typed 2 I's instead of 11, but you get the point. 28 young men bathed by the shore, 28 young men and all so friendly. 28 years of womanly life and all so lonesome. She owns the fine house by the rise of the bank. She hides handsome and richly dressed aft the blinds of the window. Which of the young men does she like the best? Ah, the homeliest of them is beautiful to her. Where are you off to, lady? For I see you. You splash in the water there, yet stay stock still in your room. Dancing and laughing along the beach came the 29th bather. The rest did not see her, but she saw them and loved them. The beards of the young men glistened with wet. It ran from their long hair. Little streams passed all over their bodies. An unseen hand also passed over their bodies. It descended tremblingly from their temples and ribs. The young men float on their backs, their white bellies bulged to the sun. They do not ask who seizes fast to them. They do not know who puffs and declines with pendant and bending arch. They do not think whom they souse with spray. That's a beautiful poem. It's full of tenderness, full of compassion for the woman who is not married, who is watching these men bathe, swim in the ocean, and how she spiritually or psychically or whatever word you want to attach to it, goes out and swims with them and becomes part of them. Walt Whitman, many people think Whitman as some kind of a nut, kind of a 19th century hippie, and he was in a way. Liked to wear his shirt open, out of the fashion of the day, wore a little amulet, a little tiki around his neck, liked to wear a hat once in a while, cocked on one side, made his father cringe many times because poor Walt would never settle down and get a job and be like everybody else and be like his brother. Walt was always off writing poems and not able to hold a job. He was a newspaper man for years and years, an editor, a freelance writer in New York. He's born in Long Island.
He was homosexual too, I believe.
Well, that opened that. I was going to get to that by a circuitous route. So much for a circuitous route. We're in there now. All right, we'll deal with that in a minute. Now I forgot what I was saying. It blew my train of thought. Yeah, and anyway, he was known as a boisterous guy, a real rake, and to write this kind of a gentle, compassionate, simple poem, I think is. Shows the other side of Whitman, that he's not all Hemingway chest pounder and celebrating himself and the smell of his armpits and all that stuff. Anybody who can write this has it all together, I think. But he could do both, as Hemingway could do both. Hemingway didn't like to do both, but the last chapter of Farewell to Arms, for example, is Hemingway at maybe his best, very compassionate, tender Hemingway. But you don't see Hemingway doing that very often. Most of the time he's biting the bullet and his heroes are dying like men, you know. And Whitman does a great deal of that. And then he could write the worst possible lines in American poetry, as number 14. The wild gander leads his flock through the cool night. Ya honk, he says. You imagine the editors in the 19th say, ya honk? What kind of a poetic word is ya honk? Well, maybe that's exactly what the wild goose sounded like to old Walt, so he put it in there. Yeah. And then there's that juxtaposition of images again in 15. The bride unrumples her white dress, the minute hand of the clock moves slowly, the opium eater reclines with rigid head and just open lips, the prostitute draggles her shawl, her bonnet bobs, and her tipsy and pimply neck. Then there's that juxtaposition of images again in 15. The bride unrumples her white dress, the minute hand of the clock moves slowly, the opium eater reclines with rigid head and just open lips, the prostitute draggles her shawl, her bonnet bobs, and her tipsy and pimply neck. Very realistic, very explicit. The 19th century wasn't used to that either. You just can't find lines like this very much outside of Walt Whitman. But Walt Whitman said, is this not so? Is this not part of life? And they'd say, yes, but you don't write about it if you're a poet. Oh, he had trouble with that theory. And in 16, he again brings us together the idea of oneness. I am of old and young, of the foolish as much as the wise, regardless of others, ever regardful of others. See, there's that paradox always. I'm regardless of others and regardful of others. Maternal as well as paternal, a child as well as a man, stuffed with the stuff that is coarse and stuffed with the stuff that is fine. And I can just see editors, knowing editors a little bit, when they see a line like that, especially in that day, they say, that is not good poetry, Walt. Stuffed with the stuff? It doesn't make any sense to say that. Can't you figure a better way to say that? Because that's what I want, stuffed with the stuff. And then he gets a little cocky at number 20. I wear my hat as I please, indoor or out. I find no sweeter fat than sticks to my own bones. I do not trouble my spirit to vindicate itself or to be understood. I see that the elementary laws never apologize. Now he's an elementary law. See, he gets kind of puffed up with himself. But he does that for, I think, the right reason, because he realizes exactly how important people really are. People are elementary laws. We don't often act like it, and I suppose it's a good idea that we don't. But once in a while, someone does recognize the power, inherent potential of people. And this is the way he said it, an elementary law, like gravity, wind, people. I am the poet of the body, and I am the poet of the soul. The pleasures of heaven are with me, and the pains of hell are with me. And with that section, he begins to go a little deeper into himself. And if I had more time, we had a week to spend on this, I would read other lines where he goes into himself and he starts experiencing more of the pain, and the pain of wars, and he's in battles, he's on shipwreck, and he's on the desert, and he's this and that, and he experiences all this kind of suffering. I am the poet of the woman, same as the man, and I say it is as great to be a woman as to be a man. And there's that great line. The scent of these armpits, aroma finer than prayer. Eventually, I must admit that Emerson, after he gave Whitman his credit, and I greet you on the threshold of a brilliant career, after the book started circulating among, quote, genteel folk, Emerson withdrew some of that support. And she shouldn't have done that. I don't know how Emerson could have done that, but he did. Now, if you're going to support somebody, support them. The minute your genteel friends find out that you've supported them, there's no time to withdraw that support. Besides which, I think Whitman is a greater poet than Emerson. Maybe that's why he withdrew a little of it. Emerson's a more philosophic poet, perhaps, but I think Whitman is a greater poet. I dote on myself, there's that lot of me, and all so luscious. Gosh. Now, 31, though, is one of those sections like 11. This is my favorite section in the entire poem. I believe a leaf of grass is no less than the journey work of the stars. That's probably my favorite line in the entire poem. And the pismire is equally perfect, and a grain of sand, and the egg of the wren, and the tree toad is a chef d'oeuvre for the highest, and the running blackberry would adorn the parlors of heaven, and the narrowest hinge in my hand puts to scorn all machinery. And the cow crunching with depressed head surpasses any statue. And a mouse is miracle enough to stagger sextillions of infidels. Now there's some theology there. Huh? There's some theology there. The running blackberry would adorn the parlors of heaven. I can remember sitting in good old Mr. Offelman's class in the eighth grade and having him explain what heaven was like. And he used some fairly traditional kinds of things to explain it, streets of gold and pillars of this and that and ivory. And I can remember even in the eighth grade thinking it was a bit cold and hard sounding. And the first time I read Walt Whitman, I thought, now there's a heaven I could go to, if I'm lucky, where the running blackberry is in heaven. I can't think of a nicer thing than the walking down lanes with running blackberries on both sides and Railroad Creek in the background. Now that's the kind of heaven I want. God, if you're listening, let my section have blackberries. And I believe a leaf of grass is no less than the journey work of the stars. Imagine people reading that. And of course he's right, absolutely right. So we had here at the Village a few years ago that the movie, The Power of Ten. Some of you have seen that other places. Where it starts out, doesn't start out with a man back of his, or in the eye, or the back of his hand. Anybody remember? It goes the distance. He goes from the man's hand up to the galaxies and explores the galaxies and the planets and all. And then it zooms back through time to the hand or the eye, whichever the hand, the end of the corpuscles and the flesh and the cells. And you see what a galaxy there is under the skin, in the skin. It's the same galaxy. Same thing. We're all related. The dust on the moon is the dust in my soul, dust in my body. And he says, what does he say? Where is he? I believe a leaf of grass is no less than the journey work of the stars. See, he intuitively knew that, just as he intuitively knew that to die is luckier than anyone supposes. That's intuition to know that in that day. The narrowest hinge in my hand puts to scorn all machinery. See, that's that childlike wonder of Whitman. Looking at a hinge and saying, what is that? What is that wonderful machine? One hinge. You find this in Zorba the Greek, and I may do Zorba next week. Zorba is forever doing that. Zorba, who is a very wise man, he'll run up to Boss, as he calls Kazantzakis in the novel, with something. What is this, Boss? What is this meat? He's about to take a great big lusty crunch of roast lamb. They're drinking wine and eating lamb. What is this wine? Kazantzakis can't tell him what it is. And he says, Boss, either the world is shrinking or I'm getting bigger. I'm going to bust. He says, I've got to know everything. I've got to know too much. And Kazantzakis, for all his wisdom and immense learning, is always so happy at Zorba asking these childlike questions. What is this? And the cow crunching with depressed head surpasses any statue. And those of you who love animals, you know what that means. Right? You see these dogs, one of these dogs, Bo, or the other dog sees one of these ground squirrels, and all of a sudden they stop and pick up that one paw. Wow. You know, Michelangelo's David, as stunning as it is has to take, as Whitman would say, hold that in abeyance while I watch that dog. And then he goes right on to say, I think I could turn and live with animals. They are so placid and self-contained. I stand and look at them long and long. And there's another one of those editor-killing lines. The editor says, what do you mean long and long? Can't you say a very long time or a half hour? But why long and long? That's like Robbie Burns, my love is like a red, red rose. The editor said, how red? Bright red? No, red, red. The editors say, oh, you poets. Well, long and long. They do not sweat and whine about their condition. They do not lie awake in the dark and weep for their sins. They do not make me sick discussing their duty to God. Not one is dissatisfied. Not one is demented with a mania of owning things. Not one kneels to another nor to his kind that lived thousands of years ago. Not one is respectable or unhappy over the whole earth. That's animals. And that's why he likes them. And I think Whitman felt a little bit like that. They do not sweat and whine about their condition. Ever seen a herd of cows munching, chewing their cud, and wondering, are you happy? I don't know if they think about it, but they just sit and do their thing. Yeah. I'm just taking out some of my favorite lines, but he's been in the bad part of his journey into himself. And with section 46, he's starting to come out of this and trying to make some kind of comments to people who may be thinking of following him. And he says, not I nor anyone else can travel the road for you. You must travel it for yourself. That becomes one of his other themes. After having gone through this excruciating journey of 52 pages, he says, I can't tell you anything. Another line in there, he says, I must hook my arm around your waist and take you to the top of the hill and point down the road and shove. You know, I can tell you how to get to Cloudy, but it's not the same thing as going. Or Dole Lakes, where I didn't go, or someplace like that. You can't ultimately do it for another person, right? You can't believe for another person. You can't live for another person. And you begin to say, why did you write a 52-page poem only to be able to say, I can't tell you what it's about. I can't tell you my vision. But he took 52 pages to tell it. You can't. Well, visions have a habit of not being able to understand them very well, right? All the great visionaries and the mystics, the blinding light is so bright and so intensely personal that you build this great construct of an apparatus and form trying to explain what you intuitively found out in a flash. And all we can do is read this construct and this form and kind of grapple with it, and it's full of metaphor and image and color. And after a while you say, I don't understand it. And Whitman is saying, I can't tell you. I have said that the soul is not more than the body. Jonathan Edwards would have died if he'd read that. And I have said that the body is not more than the soul. And nothing, not God, is greater to one than oneself is. Now there's a heavy line. See? There's a heavy line. I guess I've skipped some of those other lines, but there, as Joseph Sittler said when he got lost, it's well lost, let it go. But he does have some lines that I meant to type. He says, he was going through all the suffering of Christ. He says, I was there, I was the man, I suffered. Agonies are one of my changes of garments. And he does suffer, and he begins to come up out of this, and he realizes just how much suffering mankind is going to go through yet, and how much we've already suffered. And then he realizes that that's our lot, apparently, is to suffer a great deal. And as someone once said, the greatest tragedy of life is our ability to stand tragedy. So he winds up then with the last section. He's come back out of himself, and he's lucid again, clear-headed. The spotted hawk swoops by and accuses me. He complains of my gab and my loitering. For all his visionary stuff and his mysticism and his armpits finer than the aroma of prayer and all that kind of thing, he realizes he's a poet, and he's just saying words, and it's a new sound, and people aren't going to like it, and it's called gab. I, too, am not a bit tamed. I, too, am untranslatable. I sound my barbaric yap over the roofs of the world. The last scud of day holds back for me. It flings my likeness after the rest, and true as any on the shattered wilds. It coaxes me to the vapor and the dusk. I depart as air. I shake my white locks at the runaway sun. I effuse my flesh in eddies and drift it in lacy jags. Now, these next lines, I think, are very, very powerful lines. I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love. If you want me again, look for me under your boot soles. You will hardly know who I am or what I mean, but I shall be good health to you nevertheless, and filter and fiber your blood. Failing to fetch me at first, keep encouraged. Missing me one place, search another. I stop somewhere, waiting for you. I think it's a tremendous insight into life, knowing that intuitive insight, knowing where you are and how much we are really one, not only with each other, but with the earth. And what happens to us, we become good fodder for oak trees. And 100 years from now, we're going to be good grass or a good alder tree. I don't know if we need any more alder trees around here, or pansies or something. And not only Whitman has said that, lots of poets have made that comment. But he says it in a special, kind of a new, wild, free verse way. And he was certainly the forerunner of 20th century poetry. And nobody has said it any better than Walt Whitman. And I think Song of Myself, if you get a chance to look at it and read it through and study it a while, it'll open up some doors for you, because he was a very, very intuitive person. And he gets carried away, has these long catalogs, these long running dialogues with himself, and he forgets where he is. He's, I contradict myself? Okay, I contradict myself. And he lets it go. And that's unheard of for a poet to say something like that. In the first place, you wouldn't say it. And if you thought you were contradicting yourself, you would never say, okay, I contradict myself. And poets ever since Whitman have been talking that way. It's the conversational tone. And Frost, I'm going to talk about Frost set tomorrow. Frost is it better than anybody. Frost is talking about in that great poem, Birches, about birch trees. He said, but as I was going to say before truth broke in, with all the matter of fact about the ice storm, talking about how birch trees get, you know, bent over by ice storms, that's conversational. As I was going to say, and he got it from Whitman, and poets have got, since Whitman, have borrowed and added on to Walt Whitman. But nobody has been as intuitive and as psychical as Whitman. And I recommend them to you. Not only this poem, but Out of the Cradle, Endlessly Rocking, and the poem about Lincoln. Two poems about Lincoln. Oh, Captain, My Captain. Great, great writer. And you can find all kinds of things in Whitman, whatever you're looking for. Melody, sound. No other diction like Whitman, other than in prose, it would be like Melville, Moby Dick. The great thundering, crashing sounds of lines, line upon line. Whitman does. It can be very gentle, very quiet, very intuitive. I hope you'll read them. Thank you.